nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, we're solving the Boltzmann equation today. So we've seen the Boltzmann equation now. We know how to derive it. We know how to write it. It's this complicated-looking equation. In general, it's really difficult to solve. So if we're going to do anything analytically, we have to make a lot of simplifications. And we're going to be talking about the simplifications that are commonly used, that people just use over and over again to solve low field, near equilibrium, bulk transport, which is what we're talking about. Okay, so we have a whole list of things to get through, starting with the relaxation time approximation. So let's discuss that. One of the things that makes this equation complicated is this collision integral, right? It can really get involved. If we're going to do anything analytical, we have to simplify this thing. Okay. And first of all, just state something plausible, and then we'll come back at the later on. I'm not sure if it's in this lecture or another one, and we'll sort of talk about where it comes from. Well, first of all, let's assume non-degenerate statistics. So these 1 minus F factors, which tend to make things complicated, we can ignore. All right, then if I do this, let's see what I have here. I have two terms, and if you look at the second term, this is in scattering minus outscattering. Outscattering reduces F, that's why there's a negative sign there. In scattering increases F. If you notice, the sum is over P prime. So in the first term, the sum is over all of the other states that can scatter in and increase F. In the second sum, the sum is over P prime again, which is all of the states to which you can scatter out to, which decreases F. Now notice when we're doing a sum over P prime, that it's F of P, the state that we're looking at, so we can pull that outside the sum. And then we can sum that transition probability, the probability that we will scatter out. S of P, P prime is the probability per second that we will scatter from P to P prime. If we sum over all of the P primes we can scatter to, we get the total probability that we'll scatter somewhere. So that's a sum that can be done. And that's what people call the scattering rate. 1 over tau. It's the average time between scattering events. All right, so we can do that. So that makes it look a little bit simpler, but we still have this in-scattering thing, which is really difficult because we don't know what F is, so we can't evaluate this sum. We have to solve the Boltzmann equation to know what F is. All right. So we have a problem. This scattering rate, when we do calculations of scattering mechanisms, we're going to talk about scattering rates a lot and momentum relaxation rate and energy relaxation rate. So we'll come back to that and see it much more later on. Okay. Now, you can see that what we have here is something that is still quite complicated. We're going to make what looks like a drastic assumption, which we can justify, and we'll discuss that later on, under a couple of conditions. The outscattering rate is fine. The inscattering rate, we're going to make an assumption here. Now, this happens every class. I don't know what goes on. The inscattering rate, we're going to say we scatter in from an equilibrium distribution to this state. That's not obvious that that would work. And in fact, to make this work, this particular time is sometimes going to be a little bit different time. So we're sort of going to postulate something that looks reasonable. We're going to say that the collision operator is the deviation from equilibrium divided by some characteristic time. So it's F minus the equilibrium value divided by some characteristic time. So that, and with a negative sign. Physically, what that says is if you move away from equilibrium, scattering wants to take you back. So if you have a positive difference from equilibrium, then the df dt due to scattering wants to be negative and pull you back to equilibrium. So scattering always resists you from moving away from equilibrium. So this is a plausible thing to do. It's not completely clear what this time should be because we don't know how to make this work very well. Okay, so we're going to come back to this later, but for now, I'll simply ask you to do this, to believe that this works. We'll show what it means here in a slide or two. There's a derivation. You can actually show that this works if the scattering has some particular features. If it's isotropic, meaning it sends carriers in every direction with equal probability, then you can show that this works. Or if it's elastic, it may have preferred directions it wants to send scatter carriers, but it doesn't change their energy. And if you're near equilibrium, then you can show that this works. Okay, that's frequently okay for silicon. It's not so good for gallium arsenide, so it works for some semiconductors. It doesn't work for others.
Yeah.
All right. So let's see. We have this equilibrium distribution. Now, you notice that the equilibrium is symmetrical. In equilibrium, for every plus K state or momentum state, there's a minus K state that's occupied, so that everything averages, current averages to zero. So that equilibrium distribution is symmetric in momentum. The probability that plus P is occupied is equal to the probability that minus P is occupied. Frequently in problems, I'm going to interchangeably, just to confuse you. Sometimes I'll call it F naught, and sometimes I'll call it F sub S for symmetric. When I'm saying F sub S, it means, well, there's a quasi-Fermi level, and it might be a little different. I might have some more electrons than I did in equilibrium, but I've got this equilibrium shape. So the only thing that's different is that where I had a Fermi level, I have a quasi-Fermi level. If the carrier density is close to what it was in equilibrium, then that quasi-Fermi level is almost equal to the Fermi level. All right, so we'll call both of those the symmetric component. So then we're taking the actual solution. No current is going to flow if I only have a symmetric distribution function, because everything will average to zero. So if I look at the deviation, the actual F minus this symmetric component, that's what we'll call the anti-symmetric component. That's what makes the current flow. And the anti-symmetric component has this feature that F anti-symmetric of plus P is equal to F minus F anti-symmetric of minus P. Okay. So we divide the distribution function into the symmetric and anti-symmetric components, and it's in equilibrium, there is no anti-symmetric component. So when I deviate from equilibrium, I have an anti-symmetric component, and the bigger it is, the more scattering wants to pull us back towards equilibrium. So that's what this relaxation time approximation says. Okay, so this is the way we're going to simplify the collision integral. We're going to write that complicated collision integral with all of its SP, P primes in this simple form. And people frequently use this, even when you can't justify it. Right? It's oftentimes used because it's the only way to get an analytical solution, and it usually does something plausible. But when you're using it for a material where the scattering mechanisms aren't the right ones, you know, you have to be careful. You could have results that aren't quite right. Now, let's take a look at a simple case just to see if we can see what this is doing. Let's assume we have a uniform semiconductor, no spatial gradients. Let's assume we have no electric fields. We somehow, maybe we shine light on it and we quickly generate a whole bunch of carriers and we perturb it from equilibrium. But we don't have any gradients or electric fields. So then there's a time derivative because it will relax back to equilibrium. There are no spatial gradients. There are no electric field. So we get a very simple differential equation. Df antisymmetric dt is equal to minus F antisymmetric over tau F. All right. And that differential equation has a nice, easy solution. It's just an exponential decay. So this tells us something, you know, very plausible. If we perturb the system, it decays exponentially back to equilibrium. with a characteristic time that's given by this tau sub f that we haven't really explained what it is yet. Okay. All right. So when we're making the relaxation time approximation, that's very plausible. You've seen that in things like minority carrier diffusion. You know, lifetime, if you put some minority carriers in a semiconductor, it recombines and you go back to equilibrium. Same kind of equation. So if you had to guess something, you know, this is the kind of thing you would guess. Deviation from equilibrium divided by some characteristic time with a minus sign to pull you back to equilibrium. All right. Now we can solve the Boltzmann equation. We've simplified the collision integral. We can solve it. We're not going to solve it under general conditions. You know, in general, there are diffusion gradients, there are temperature gradients, there are electric fields, there are magnetic fields. We can put all of those in and solve it. But the point in this lecture is to do it under some simple conditions just to see how it all works. We'll do it generally later on. Okay, so we have this Boltzmann equation. You know, I'm going to go back and forth. Sometimes I'll be working with P, and P is H bar K, so don't get confused if sometimes I label it K and sometimes I label it P. Let's take a case where we just have a resistor with a uniform carrier density. No spatial gradients in F, but there's an electric field, so we can get some current to flow. Let's say it's steady state. So the time derivative is zero, the spatial derivative is zero, and we get this steady state, spatially homogeneous Boltzmann equation in the relaxation time approximation. That's the equation that we want to solve. Now, we're going to make a reasonable assumption. And actually, when you get all done, you can go back and you can convince yourself that it was reasonable. But we're going to say that when we take the derivative of F with respect to momentum, there's a big symmetric part that was there in equilibrium, which and then there's a little anti-symmetric part when you perturb it from equilibrium, and that carries all of the current. If I want to differentiate F with respect to Px, momentum, the assumption we're going to make is that we can just differentiate the big part, right? But the small part we don't have to worry about here. Yes?
So this assumption is for low bias?
This assumption is for low bias. That's
so
right.
For high bias, the symmetric part also gives
protection? For high bias, for high bias, you worry about this. And when we get to high field transport, we'll show that you can do some things that are just a little bit different, but that are plausible. But this is for low bias. So it's a reasonable thing to try for low bias. Okay, so now I can solve this equation for the unknown F. It's easy to solve. So the unknown F is just the equilibrium F, and then I get I get two minus signs here, so I get a plus Q tau electric field times dF dPx. I've solved the Boltzmann equation, and we just have to make sense out of it. All right. So to begin with, let me assume that this characteristic time, which might depend on energy, let's assume that it doesn't. It's just constant. And then let's see if we can figure out what this solution is telling us. So remember, if I took a Taylor series expansion of a function, so if I wanted to know what the function was at x plus dx, I would take the function at x, I would take its derivative and multiply by a little dx, and I would ignore this higher order terms if it was small enough. That sort of looks like what I'm doing here. I have the function at p, and then I have something times the first derivative of the function. It looks like I'm doing a Taylor series expansion of something. So in fact, what this solution is it's the equilibrium distribution, but at a location p plus some dp. So what we're seeing here is the equilibrium distribution plus the derivative of the equilibrium distribution, and the dp is q tau ef. That's like the dx in this equation. So it's like we're just evaluating the equilibrium solution at a different p. So what's happened here? We had this equilibrium distribution that was just nice and symmetric, carried no current. The solution says that if I put a plus electric field on, that I should, if I want to evaluate, I need a new battery here. If I want to evaluate F All I do is evaluate it at a different P. Boom. And the amount that I shift it by is minus Q tau EX. All right. So that gives me a nice physical explanation. You know, if I know that my equation of motion says dP dt is, well, let's say dPx dt is minus Q times the electric field in the x direction. If I say I can push for a time tau, and then I scatter and it goes back, so then dP is this times tau. So if I have a plus electric field, we just push all of the electrons in the minus x direction. And we can't push too far because the scattering stops it. So we call this a displaced Maxwellian. We've just taken the equilibrium distribution and we've shifted it off center a little bit. So now there's an average current that can flow because now the plus momentum and the minus momentums are a little bit different. It's exaggerated in this figure, and I'll get a net current flow. So people will say that the solution to the Boltzmann equation under low fields in a bulk semiconductor is a displaced Maxwellian. Now under high fields, other things, it'll be much more complicated. You'll put energy in, the distribution will broaden, and it might even change shape. But in this case, it's easy to see. And now it's sort of easy to see what the average momentum is. The average momentum is the value at the peak. In equilibrium, it was zero, no current flows. But when the electric field is applied, the average momentum is minus Q tau times EX. You know, you don't have to do an integral or anything to see what the average is. It's just right at the peak. Okay, the average velocity, it's just average momentum divided by M. The average momentum was minus Q tau EX divided by mass. And what we're finding is that the average velocity is minus mu times the electric field. And the mobility is Q tau over M. Right? So we get results that are sort of what we would expect. If I want to get the conductivity in 1D, 2D, or 3D, I would just take NQ times this mu, and we would have the resistance. Right? Okay. Okay, so there's another way to solve it. When we do this in general, we're going to have to use a different procedure. So let me look at a different way to get the same answer. So this was the Boltzmann equation that we were solving. Okay? And this is the solution that we got. And we did a physical interpretation of that, like a Taylor series expansion, and we said this looks like we've just pushed the distribution off center, and we interpreted it that way. But let me just look at it mathematically. Let me take the df dp and write it as df dE times dE dp. And what's dE dp? dE dp is x-directed velocity. And df dE, well, if I have a non-degenerate semiconductor, which I assumed right at the beginning, then when I take that derivative, it's just going to bring down a minus 1 over kt times f. And when I take that derivative with respect to momentum, it's going to give me velocity. So we end up with this minus Q tau E F naught divided by KT times velocity. So now we're just looking at this mathematically. So that's our anti-symmetric component. And you can see it has a velocity there, P divided by M. So it'll be positive for plus P, it'll be negative for minus P. Just like the anti-symmetric component should be. Okay, now if I want to get, you know, when we looked at this as a displaced Maxwellian, I just looked at the picture and I said what the average momentum was. Okay, if I want to compute the average momentum, which we'll have to do when things get more complicated, you know, then we'll have to work out a sum like this. If I want the average velocity, I'll just take the velocity, I'll weight it by the probability that the state is occupied, I'll sum over all the states, and then I have to divide by a normalization sum, okay? Because F isn't normalized to 1, right? Now, when I do the top sum, there's a sum over the symmetric part plus the anti-symmetric part. But the velocity here is anti-symmetric. So when I sum over the symmetric part, that gives me zero. Right? Because I'll have a negative V on the positive half side, I'll have a negative V on the negative side, I'll have a positive V on the positive side, it'll all sum to zero. So when I do that sum upstairs, I only need to sum the anti-symmetric component. And that's the part we just solved for. Okay. Now, when I do the sum downstairs, what's that? You can recognize that? You know what that is. Pardon me? That's the number of electrons. We're just summing up all of the states that are occupied, dividing by the volume. That's the electron density per unit volume. So the average velocity is 1 over electron density per unit volume. Then I've got a 1 over volume on the top. I need to do this sum. I take Vx times Fa. Let me pull a kT out front. I really wish I had a better... I don't even know. They're AAA. All right, we'll just have to get by with it. It's better when you're viewing it on the web anyway, because you can't see the pointer on the web. So I actually shouldn't be using the pointer. Okay, so look at this equation, the one in the middle. We pulled the kT out. I have a Vx because I'm evaluating current, but I also had a Vx in my solution to the anisometric component, so there's a Vx squared times tau as a function of energy. Okay. Now, this sum here, I'm taking the quantity Vx squared tau, I'm weighting it by the probability that the state is occupied, but I'm not dividing it by the normalization factor, the sum over F naught. So that is really n times the average value of that quantity that's multiplying f. So when I look at that, I can recognize that as I'm doing an average there. It's n times the average value of Vx squared tau. So the average velocity is this. It's q times the average value of Vx squared tau. The average is taken over an equilibrium distribution. So I'm weighting the quantity by the equilibrium probability that it's occupied. And I'm computing the average value of Vx squared tau, and then I'm divided by kT. All right. So let me make life simple by assuming for now that tau is constant, although it almost never is. We'll have to worry about that later. Then I can pull the tau naught out. And all I have to do is to figure out what the average value of Vx squared is. Well, let me multiply Vx squared by m and divide by 2. So now I'm asking, what's the average value of 1/2 mv squared? And I had to divide by m over 2 in order to do that. So the average value of 1/2 mv squared is an energy. But it's not the total energy because it's only Vx squared. There's a Vy squared and a Vz squared. And they're low field, everything is symmetric. So it's actually 1/3 of the kinetic energy. Right. The kinetic energy is 3/2 kT on the non-degenerate. 1/3 of it is 1/2 kT. So I could work that all out, but I know what answer I'm going to get. It's the average kinetic energy associated with one degree of freedom, it's 1/2 kT. Well, I have a 1/2 kT downstairs. So when I get all done, I get velocity is minus mu times the electric field, and the mu is q tau over m. It was a lot easier the first way I did it. But when we solve the BTE generally, we're going to have to do it this way. Right? When we put in magnetic fields and concentration gradients and thermal gradients and everything else. All right. Questions? Yes.
With the use of the equipartition theorem in the last slide.
Pardon?
With the use of the equipartition theorem in the last slide, we make any assumption for the dimensionality of this theory? For the dimensionality, we make any assumption?
Yeah, so everything, you see, I have these 1 over omegas in my derivation. So I'm doing everything in 3D. You could work out, you could solve this in 2D, like for an inversion layer of a MOSFET. You could solve it in 1D in a wire. And I would, you'd have to go through a different set of arguments, but, you know, the story would be close to the same. Yeah.
Okay, so in page 9, you want to derivate the F with respect to Px.
Mm-hmm.
You change the F to F naught. So you said that you want only the anti-symmetric part, but why did you change it to F naught?
Well, so yeah, this is, you have to be a little bit careful about when to use F and when to use F naught. And let's see. You know, this is another example here. When I'm doing, I'm on page 13 now. If you look at that top sum, you can see that I'm multiplying something that is odd in momentum. The velocity changes sign from plus and minus momentum. Times something that has two components. One that's symmetric in momentum, a big one, and one that's anti-symmetric. So there I can see that the big one will give me zero because it's an even function times an odd function, and it'll integrate to zero. The small anti-symmetric part will give me the odd Vx times the anti-symmetric part. That'll give me an even contribution. So I can look at the numerator there and say only the small part is going to give me something. Now, when I look in the denominator, I'm just adding up all the states. And now only the big part is going to matter. Now, similarly, when you're doing that derivative, I'm just taking a derivative of the total thing. Only the big part is going to matter. So, you know, you can go, now that we've solved it, you can go back and evaluate that derivative with a full solution, the symmetric plus the anti-symmetric part. And what you'll find is that the derivative of the anti-symmetric part is small compared to the derivative of the symmetric part. Okay. So, you know, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip the next section and ask you to go through it. And I'll just explain to you what the point is, and then you can work it through yourself on your own. So here I'm just doing another situation. Steady state transport, but now no electric field. But now there can be gradients in the carrier density. So I should get a diffusion current. Right? I can guess what the answer is going to be. So you can work through a similar set of arguments, and I'll let you do that. But what you will find if you work through that is that the average velocity is minus diffusion coefficient times 1 over n dn dx. That's what replaces velocity as minus mu times the electric field. When there is no electric field, there are only diffusion gradients. And you'll find that the definition of the diffusion coefficient is that it's the average value of Vx squared times tau. And you'll find also, when you work that out, that you can relate it to a mobility, and that d over mu is kt over q. Right? So you'll find all of the things that you're used to seeing. And then if you take that solution, which I'll ask you to go through on your own, the solution we just went through, the first one here on the left is the drift part that we talked about. The second one is the diffusion part, which proceeds along similar lines, and you can follow it on your own. If I add the two, I'm going to get a drift diffusion equation. So the total current is minus nq times the average velocity. Part of the average velocity is due to drift. Part of the average velocity is due to diffusion. You add the two components, and we get our drift diffusion equation. Now, this is an awful lot of work to get at something that we knew. Right? So the power of the Boltzmann equation is that when you have to go beyond this and things are a little more complicated, you follow the same procedure and you get the answer. Now, one of the major things that happens is that these scattering times are almost always energy dependent. It's hard to imagine a scattering time that doesn't depend on energy. More energetic electrons want to scatter more. There are more ways that they can scatter. There are more states that they can scatter to. So we have to eliminate that assumption. And let me do that. So So this is basically what we found. We have a definition for the diffusion coefficient. We have a Einstein relation that relates the diffusion coefficient and the mobility. We have a drift velocity that's minus mobility times electric field. Okay. So if I put these together without the assumption that the scattering time is constant, we find that the mobility is q times the average value of vx squared tau divided by kt. That's what the mobility is. And now let's evaluate that without making the assumption that the scattering time is a constant. All right. I'm near equilibrium. So the magnitude of the velocity squared is v squared is vx squared plus vy squared plus vz squared. In equilibrium, they're all equal. Vx squared is one-third of the magnitude of, you know, they each contribute one-third. They're equal, and they each contribute one-third to the total magnitude of the velocity squared. We're talking about near equilibrium here. So we apply a small electric field. They're still almost equal. So I can replace Vx squared with one-third of V squared. I could replace it with Vz squared. I could replace it with Vy squared. They're all equal. So that's where the 3 comes in here. So now we have to compute this. It's Q over 3kT. Average value of v squared tau. Now what I'm going to do, I'm trying to save, I could just sit down and work out the integral and we could get the answer. I'm trying to save myself some work by putting it in a form that I can look at it and say, I know what that integral is, I don't need to work it out. So let me divide by v squared and multiply, let me divide by the average value of v squared and multiply by the average value of v squared. I haven't done anything. Okay. Well, 1/2 mv squared I recognize as kinetic energy. So let me put a 1/2 mv squared in the last bracket. And let's see, then I have to multiply by 2 over m. So that gives me a 3/2 kt. Looks like I have a typo here. That should be a 1 over m. So I'm just multiplying and dividing through by 1/2 m. Now that means I can take the q and I divide it by m here. That's a typo there. Average value of 1/2 mv squared. That's the average kinetic energy. That's 3/2 kt. Right? I don't need to work out that integral. Right? We did that, I think, back in the first or second lecture. So that's 3/2 kt. It cancels the 3/2 kt that was there, and they disappear. So now I have mobility is q over m times average value of v squared tau divided by the average value of v squared. Okay. We're going to define that as some specially defined average that comes up in transport, because it's not a real average. Now, a real average, you take a quantity, you weight it by a probability that it's occupation probability, you sum over all the states, you divide by the sum of that occupation probability to normalize it. So average value of v squared tau is a proper average over the equilibrium distribution. Average value of v squared is a proper average. This double bracket here is to denote that this is some special average that pops up when you do transport. Sometimes people don't show the double bracket. And you have to be careful. It's not an actual average. It's a specially defined, some people call it a transport average. Now, I could put a 1/2 m on the top, and I could divide and put a 1/2 m on the bottom. And that way I would recognize that what I'm doing is averaging energy times tau. So I take the average value of energy times tau, and I divide it by the average value of energy. All right. And the point I'm making here is that, you know, a proper average takes a quantity, weights it by the distribution function, and normalizes it. All right. Oftentimes, we will find that you can describe this scattering time in a simple way. People call power law scattering. It's energy divided by kT to some characteristic exponent. And each scattering mechanism will have a different exponent. You can't do this for every scattering mechanism, but it works for some common ones. And if you work this out, and I won't do it here today, you'll find out that it's this factor tau naught here, which is constant. So the average value of the characteristic time is tau naught times the gamma function with argument s plus 5 halves divided by the gamma function with argument 5 halves. So if you know s, if you know the characteristic exponent that describes your scattering, then you can figure out what this average is. You can put it in q average tau over m, and you've got your mobility. Okay. So this is just a summary, and it's something you need to know because we see frequently over and over again. If you want to compute the mobility for acoustic phonon scattering, well, that has an S of minus 1/2. Ionized impurity scattering has an S of plus 1/2. So, you know, if you review how gamma functions work, you can work out what those are. Okay. All right. I'm covering a lot of material, and I'm encouraging you to sit down with this afterwards, go through it, make sure you're comfortable with this, because we're doing it a little simpler here to show how it works, and then we will do it more completely in the next few lectures where I'll assume that you know how this all works. Now, what we've done is to solve almost the same problem that we've been talking about with the Landauer approach. So the two answers should be really, we would hope that they would be the same. It's not quite obvious how to get ballistic transport into this picture that I've talked. So I don't expect to be able to do ballistic this way. But in the diffusive limit, I should get the same answers. So let's look at this answer. This is our solution to the Boltzmann equation with a small electric field. If I want to compute the current along the x-axis, then I'll just produce a sum like this. I could convert my sum to an integral. I'm doing it in 1D now. So I simply have an integral. And now, if I want to relate this to Landauer, everything in Landauer had a 2q squared over h in front of it. So let me pull out a 2q squared over h to try to make it look like the Landauer expressions. Let's see. What did I do here? Where are my factors of 2? I'm going to have to check. So I've converted this integral from minus infinity to plus infinity to an integral from 0 to plus infinity, so I get a factor of 2 there. We're going to have to see whether I have a problem here. Where'd that other factor of 2 come from? Oh, no, where did it come from? I've got a factor of 2 here that I can't quite, I don't see where it's coming from. Pardon me?
You're replacing h bar by h over 2 pi. So the pi's are getting canceled and you're getting an extra number 2. So you're replacing vk with vk. So there should be an h bar.
H bar where? I think you're right, but I'm not quite seeing it here. Which line are you pointing me at?
So when you go from the second line to the third line.
Yeah.
So then you're replacing dk by dk, right?
Ah, you're right. Yeah, good. So the rest of you see that? Yeah. We're converting the integral from dk to dE, right? So we take a, I'm taking a dh bar k dE times dE, which is giving me a velocity, and that h bar is giving me an h over, I have to divide by h bar, And yeah, that's what's doing it there. Yeah. Okay, so I got one factor of 2 from that h bar, and I got another factor of 2 because I converted the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity, and I've got an expression that looks like this. If I define 2 vx tau to be the mean free path, then I've got an expression that's on the bottom line. Now, the Landauer formula doesn't give me current related to electric field. It gives me current related to potential drop. So I have to multiply the electric field by potential, by length of the resistor, and then I have to divide by length. So electric field times length is minus the potential drop. So that gets rid of the negative sign here. That gives me a voltage. And now I have a lambda over L. Lambda over L starts to look like something I've seen before. That's a transmission in the diffusive limit. All right. So we have a nice warm feeling that we get the results we've seen before. And remember, the only thing that might be a little surprising is this factor of 2 here, but we've seen that before. And that comes because when an electron scatters, it might forward scatter. Half the time it'll forward scatter, and that doesn't really hurt us in 1D. Half the time it'll backward scatter. So it's got to scatter twice before it really does any damage. And that's why we get 2V times tau. All right. So, you know, we have an alternative, and it gives us 2 different physical ways to look at the same problem. You know, one of the advantages of the Landauer approach is it gives us a nice natural way to treat the ballistic problem. It's a little harder to see how to do the ballistic problem with the Boltzmann equation. And, you know, we can also interpret some things here. If I go back to, when I do the Boltzmann solution, these DFDEs came in. And those DFDEs just appeared mathematically when I was doing the chain rule. It didn't have any physical significance. But if you think about this in a Landauer framework, you know where that DFDE came from. That was telling us the difference between F1 and F2 in a Taylor series expansion and what made the current flow. So we get a different perspective that can sometimes be useful. Okay, one or two other quick things and we'll finish up. You know, what if we've got more than one scattering mechanism happening at the same time? Well, then I have 2 different ways to relax the equilibrium. So I would just add them. And I have 2 different characteristic times, say acoustic phonon scattering and ionized impurity scattering. All right, and that's some total scattering rate. So the total scattering rates would add. The times wouldn't add. If I've got 2 scattering mechanisms, I don't add the times because they'll scatter more often. I add their inverse times or their scattering rates. Let's say that each one of those is described by a power law scattering. So it has a characteristic exponent, say, for acoustic phonon scattering, and it has a characteristic exponent for ionized impurity scattering. And you add, you'll add those 2 together. But they might be different. So when you add the 2 together to get the total scattering rate, it's not in power law form. We can still, write a little MATLAB script and we can evaluate this average because we know how to do that. But it won't evaluate as simply as it would have otherwise. So now let's see. What if I have a situation where those 2 different scattering mechanisms just happen to have the same energy dependence? Right? Then when I add the 2 scattering rates, I will get a characteristic time that is in power law form because there's only 1 S. They're the same for both. And now when I compute this average, it'll be the tau naught total, and I'll get the same gamma factors. And now what we'll find is that 1 over mu total is 1 over mu first plus 1 over mu second. This is what's called Mathiasen's rule. Okay. But it can only be justified when the 2 scattering mechanisms have the same energy dependence, which almost never occurs. So, and yet, it's generally used. It's used because it does something plausible. But people that are careful when they do these calculations worry about things like this. You could have quantitative problems. If your scattering mechanisms have different energy dependencies, then in principle you can't add them with Mathiasen's rule. And of course, if you get the materials like silicon and you have ellipsoidal bands, you have to be much more careful about how you do all of these calculations. You know, if we're thinking about current flow, you know, then we're thinking about, say, velocities in the direction of current flow. So that'll depend on the mass in the direction of the current flow. So if I'm doing these calculations, say, for the two red bellies here, they have the longitudinal mass. And I could compute a mobility, q tau over m longitudinal, for those two valleys. The other four valleys, though, will have an x-directed mass that is a transverse mass. So if I want to know the mobility for those four valleys, it would be q tau over transverse mass. Near equilibrium, 1/6 of the electrons are in each valley. So if I want the total conductivity, I would just add them all up. And if you add them all up and you want to combine everything so that the final result looks like a mobility that's q tau over m, when you add all of those terms together and collect it all up, what you can do is to define something else that has the units of mass, and people call a conductivity effective mass. So this is like a density of states effective mass. A density of states effective mass you use when you're computing the carrier densities. And it's just some collection of the effective masses so that the proper expression looks like the simple expression. The conductivity effective mass is not a physical effective mass. It's some combination of the physical effective mass that makes the mobility expression look like the simple mobility expression. So if you've got germanium and you've got materials where valleys are oriented differently, you have to look at how the conductivity effective mass would look in that case. Okay, so that's it. It was a lot of material. I think it's relatively straightforward. Please go through section 3, which is very much like section 2, but you can see how it works out for diffusion. And you've seen really all of the physical concepts. Mostly what we're going to do now for the next 3 or 4 lectures is to try to solve the Boltzmann equation more generally. And it'll involve the same kind of mathematics that we did here. We just have to be a little more careful about, we have more terms to consider and more things to do. Okay, we will continue with the Boltzmann equation on Monday, and I should be able to tell you what the exam 1 is like on Monday as well. Okay.